Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with Mark Straczynski, General Director of West Edge Opera, about the company's 2018 Summer Festival, which includes productions of Debussy's Pelléas and Mélisande, Luca Francesconi's Quartet, and Matt Mark's Mata Hari. Also on the operatic front, from the Marilla Opera Program of the San Francisco Opera, we'll talk with Robin Guarino, who directs Stravinsky's opera, The Rake's Progress, as part of the 2018 Marilla Summer Festival. Open-air producer Neil Swinkles pre-taped a conversation with artistic director Jeffrey Thomas of the American Bach Soloists to talk about the 9th annual ABS Festival and Academy, which focuses on Baroque music from Germany, with a particular emphasis on the glorious court of Dresden. Plus, Open Air's regular contributor and critic-at-large Peter Robinson talks about travel writing and has a conversation with children's picture book author Jean Walker Harvey about her new book, Boats on the Bay, due to be published later this month. Stay with us. Evocative music from Claude Debussy's only opera, Pelléas et Mélisande, which will be presented as part of the West Edge Opera's Summer Festival, which runs through August 19th, and also includes works by Luca Francesconi, his quartet, and Matt Mark's Mata Hari. It's a pleasure to welcome back Mark Straczynski to Open Air. Almost as fun to say as LaTulipe. Mark's innovative work goes far beyond what he's done with the West Edge Opera, including work with the San Francisco, Dallas, L.A., and New York City opera companies. He's also directed his own productions for Florida Grand Opera, Opera Theater of St. Louis, Seattle Opera, Dallas Opera, Michigan Opera, Boston Baroque, Cincinnati Opera, and the Lyric Opera of Kansas City, as well as others. He also wrote the libretto for and directed Machine, a quite aptly described fire opera for, appropriately, The Crucible in Oakland.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome back to you, Mark.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, continuing with your always compelling choices for West Edge Opera, give us a snapshot of the Summer Festival. Although I should say snapshot.
Snapshot is our other program.
Your other program, yeah. that offers.
Yeah, in the wintertime, Snapshot is our program of New Work Sampler. We start on Saturday with Pelléas and Mélisande, and Sunday afternoon is Mata Hari, which is sort of almost a crossover piece. You might call it music theater. Is it a musical? Is it an opera? One of those pieces where you can't quite tell. Mata Hari herself is an actress surrounded by singers, and there's an electronics aspect. And then Quartet is our really big extravaganza. It's actually only two people. They play multiple parts, but the piece has both a live orchestra and, as part of the electronics package, the La Scala Orchestra and chorus you'll hear played together in mixture with the singers whose voices are manipulated electronically and our live orchestra of about 25. So that piece is really going to be something.
We'll drill down on that one in a moment.
Yeah.
But one of the hallmarks of West Edge Opera is the unique venues
right. You've
secured over the years. Each, I know, with its own set of challenges.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about this year's venue, the Craneway Conference Center.
Yeah, the Craneway. Most people know the Craneway Pavilion, which is on the Richmond waterfront. It's an enormous space with big windows out onto the bay, and the Oakland Symphony does their 4th of July concert and fireworks out there. The space that the entire building is called Ford Point. It's an old Ford assembly plant, which was reconditioned, I think, about 10 years ago or so, and made into a large business park, including the event space. These two event spaces. Ours is called the Conference Center, and it's also a big raw space farther back down the building with windows out onto the bay, but much more appropriate for us and a lesser used space, so we could take over the entire space for a month and a half and do our entire festival of three operas in 3 weekends.
Mm-hmm. And maybe using that in the future? Are you...
Possibly. We're never quite sure. It all depends on what their plans are for the space and its availability. There's many people know that there's a new ferry terminal going in right across the street from the space, and that'll be open next year. So who knows if they'll have other plans for that space at that point. They're not telling us yet, but we're in constant talks with them about mm-hmm. that.
Well, let's back up now to the first offering of the West Edge Opera season, Pelléas et Mélisande, which we had but a taste.
Yeah, Pelléas is a very, I mean, often thought of as a very meditative, ethereal piece, and the West Edge take on it is much more, I would say, much more gripping, and it's really a compelling piece. This mysterious woman comes into the midst of this very kind of sad, sick place, and really kind of turns it all on end. We're giving it a little bit more of a lively take in that the central character of Mélisande is much more kind of in control of her own destiny, and the Jonathan Kuhner, who's our conductor and music director, has taken rather than focusing on the traditions of the piece in the last maybe 20, 30, 40 years, he's gone back and really worked on Debussy's score and thinking about his intentions musically. And it moves along much faster than any other production that I've seen. I tend to find this opera to be kind of sleepy, but this production, not at all. It's really gripping, and very excited to present these singers, former Adler Fellow Efrain Solis as Golo, David Blaylock as Pelléas, and Kendra Broom as Mélisande. Kendra is a really interesting singer. I think she's going to be super famous. She started out in the organization in the Bay Area, YMCO, Young Musicians Choral Orchestra, which is a program for underprivileged youth, mentored by Frederica von Stade, our Flicka.
We love Flicka.
We love Flicka. And Flicka grabbed me when she found out that we were doing Pelléas and said, you must listen to Kendra Broom and consider her. And we were blown away. And she is outrageously talented, gorgeous, and the performance she gives us is really not to be missed.
Well, I understand there's another central character in Pelléas and Mélisande, courtesy of Jolie Odell.
That's right. Yeah. Every single scene has different hair for Mélisande. Mélisande is well known for having long hair. In fact, the tower scene, which we just heard a little bit of, and I think we might play a little bit more, her hair goes all the way down, I think 7-8 feet. And at one point, Golo pulls her by her hair, and at one point she has her hair in the fountain and gets it wet, and at one point, well, I won't say what happens at the end, that would be giving it away, but every time she appears on stage, she looks like she has the same hair, but it's actually a different wig that does a different thing, and Jolie has done an amazing job creating all this hair at once. She has pictures of the massive amount of red hair that she has collected to make these wigs.
Well, before we move on to Mata Hari by Matt Marks, let's hear the end of that tower scene set up. We heard the beginning, the beautiful orchestral beginning of that. What are we going to hear vocally in the tower scene?
Oh, this is she's brushing her hair. It's in the late evening, and Pelléas appears below her window, and she's just singing this little beautiful song. That's one of the only times she really gets to sing for an extended period of time.
From Pelléas et Mélisande. the tower scene of Claude Debussy's only opera, Pelléas et Mélisande, which is being done by the West Edge Opera on August 4th, 12th, and 17th. WestEdgeOpera.org for more information. Talking with Mark Straczynski, the director of the productions at West Edge Opera. That should be a beautiful sight to behold, yeah, as well as to hear.
I mean,
Debussy's music is just out of this world.
It's beautiful.
And then moving on to the second production, Mata Hari.
Yeah.
The Femme Fatale.
Yeah, this is a production that I saw in early 2017 at its premiere in New York by the fantastic composer Matt Marks and librettist Paul Pierce, who's also the director. Sadly, 2 months ago, Matt Marks passed away at the age of 48.
My.
So it was a real tragedy, and we've dedicated this production to him and to his memory. The piece is, it's Mata Hari spending the last, you know, her last week or so in jail in prison before she's executed for espionage, and she makes a close personal relationship with the nun who's there to kind of supervise her and take care of her, who's quite kind of mean and angry at the beginning, and as she learns Mata Hari's story, she kind of melts, and then this is a real character from history. It was said that at Mata Hari's execution, the sister that took care of her was weeping openly, and so this kind of inspired Paul Pierce to imagine this relationship. And so they're accompanied by five men who play the different soldiers and army men who she cavorted with and had relationships with, including her first husband, etc. Tina Mitchell plays Mata Hari. She's an actress, not a singer, surrounded by singers. So I think we have an excerpt.
We're going to hear.
Yeah, it's her first interrogation, I think, by Captain Bouchardon.
From Matt Marks, Mata Hari.
Matahari, the eye of the day in Javanese, according to the translation you gave me, the ex-wife of Major Rudolph MacLeod. Never remarried, how unfortunate for such an attractive lady with your coppery skin, charming smile, who graces the floor with such swinging of your hips. Surely you'd have found another man to spend your life with, maybe one of the 53 men I hold in the palm of my hand is the one.
From Matt Marks, Mata Hari, being done by the West Edge Opera on August 5th, 10th, and 18th. WestEdgeOpera.org for more details about those productions. And moving on to what's looks like a fascinating production of Quartet. And if you go to our website, klw.org, you'll see one of the publicity photos, fascinating photo of Hadley Adams as Valmont and Heather Buck as Merteuil.
Yeah.
Characters from Les Liaisons Dangereuses.
That is correct.
So tell us about, and I understand it's quite a set you've created for
it
this.
It is, yeah. Heiner Müller, a very, very well-known playwright, post-Brechtian, I would say, in Europe, created this piece taken from La Close, Dangerous Liaisons, and really taking it one step further. It's the two characters, and then they switch genders and play the other lovers in the story of Dangerous Liaisons. But it really is compacted. It's as if they're in a loop over and over again, reliving their angry love affair, And it really is, I think, for lovers of modern music, people will go absolutely crazy for this piece. And even if you're not so into modern music, I think just the enormity, the excitement of this piece is really important to bring people to really see what's on the cutting edge of the opera world. The story is non-narrative in a sense, but there is definitely a beginning, middle, and end. It's just something not to be believed, and it's very, very hard to describe. We've actually spent a lot of time saying, "Is there an elevator speech for this piece?" It's hard to really disseminate what this piece is, I just encourage everyone to take a chance on it and come out, and I think you'll be blown away.
Well, let's hear a little bit of it. Yeah. What are we going to hear from this work?
Yeah, this is, there's two components to this. There's the orchestra that's recorded from La Scala, and there's the live orchestra mixed together with the singing.
From Luca Francesconi's quartet. Too brief excerpt from Francesconi's quartet, which will feature Hadley Adams as Valmont and Heather Buck as Murtoy, part of the production being staged by the West Edge Opera, westedgeopera.org for more information. Interesting that Francesconi himself had said, "Don't dare to come if you can't accept that you need to analyze what you do and who you are. This piece is violent. It's sex. It's blasphemy. It's the absence of mercy." Mm. That'll entice the audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Itself, as well as the incredibly enticing press photo.
And directed by Elkanah Pulitzer, who did our Lulu and our Powder Her Face, and it's kind of finishes up a trilogy of really decadent, debauched pieces that she brings to us.
Wow. Those productions.
Some of our most successful pieces.
And a wraparound set, as you mentioned, going all the way around the orchestras, one of which is recorded, so two orchestra. Quite a production of quartet on August 11th, 16th, and 19th, West Edge Opera. Mark Straczynski, I thank you for coming in. All Too Brief, once again, I will point people to the westedgeopera.org website, where the full interview with Sarah Cahill for Revolutions Per Minute is posted, so you can get a little bit more in-depth sample of the works that are coming up for West Edge Opera. Thanks
for
again for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, from Straczynski, we move to Stravinsky. And speaking of Hadley Adams, who was a Marilla alum, we're going to be talking about the Marilla's production of A Rake's Progress, The Rake's Progress by Igor Stravinsky. Stay with us. That's music from the lively score of Igor Stravinsky's The Rake's Progress, which will enjoy a fully staged production by San Francisco's acclaimed Marilla Opera Program, one of the most prestigious and selective opera training programs in the world. This fully staged production is based loosely on the eponymous 8 paintings and engravings by William Hogarth, The Rake's Progress, and follows the decline and fall of a profligate heir who makes a devil's bargain with Nick Shadow, abandoning life in the country and his tender fiancée for the wicked temptations of London. The productions will be tonight at 7:30 at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, and again Sunday afternoon at 2. Performances will be conducted by Mark Marash, himself a Marilla alum and currently director of musical studies at the San Francisco Opera. The production is directed by Robin Guarino, who has staged lauded productions at the Metropolitan Opera, Seattle Opera, Glimmerglass Opera, Juilliard Opera Center, and many more. In addition to her career directing opera and theater, she has produced and directed 4 independent films, and she joins me in the studio. Hi, Robin. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
And I understand you have a connection with my previous guest as well. You've worked with Mark.
Well, I've known Mark for, I want to say our children played together 20 years ago. we first met at Seattle Opera years ago during a production of The Ring that I was an associate director on.
Nice. Well, a production of Merula must come with a different set of expectations and excitement. You've worked with many professional opera companies, but it must be very recharging to be around the energy level of these young rising stars.
Oh, it's fantastic, because they're just on the precipice, and they're so bright and willing, and they're not afraid of hard work. And so it keeps the stakes really high.
Tell us about the cast that's been assembled for this work, for the Stravinsky.
It's a fantastic cast, as usual, assembled by Sherry Grunewald and Mark Marash, because it's not only can they sing it and they have phenomenal voices, but they are perfect for the roles. We have a great devil, a great Nick Shadow in Jacob Scharfman, and our Tom is sung by Christopher Oglesby. He's just phenomenal, and True Love, Megwe Zhang, and they are all phenomenal.
Well, Stravinsky's music must present its own set of challenges. It's a very rhythmic, energetic score, a libretto in English, which doesn't leave places to hide, shall we say.
Well, you have to be really clear about not only literal meaning, but idiomatic meaning and poetic meaning, and you just can't take it for granted. We spend a lot of time talking about what does this phrase mean. Of course, since it's in English, audiences expect perfect diction. And
And now tell us about your production.
The production. I guess it's a little bit out of the ordinary. We have staged this Rake's Progress at a party that's taking place. And the guests at the party are audience members, but they also become participants, and they're slowly immersed into the whole story of the Rake's Progress. And they become players along with Tom Rakewell.
What are we going to see visually?
You'll see all of the episodes that Tom goes to, the country home, and then Mother Goose's brothel, with all the things that take place in brothels. And
just like the children's books.
Yes, exactly. And Bedlam and a graveyard. And, I mean, I've created a space with set designer Donald Eastman, who's one of the greats, where the story can take place fluidly and seamlessly without waiting for any transition. So it's done with a lot of imagination and lights and costumes and phenomenal acting.
And full orchestra, we should mention.
And full orchestra, which is a huge character in the piece.
And this will be at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music for tonight's production is at 7:30. Saturday's is at 2 o'clock. Have you done productions of The Rake's Progress before?
This is my second one.
Second one. Where was the other?
The other one was at the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, and it was completely different because we used projections during that. So that was the way we dealt with sort of fluidly going from scene to scene. But I rather like this one better.
Well, Stravinsky intended to evoke the memory of Mozart, but you also have some sort of quasi-salutes to Rossini, Verdi, and Handel. When one thinks of Stravinsky, one doesn't think of such lyric, interesting, on the audience's ear writing instead of being jarring. It's quite lyrical.
Mm-hmm. It is. And, he's all over the 21st century in the music. you know, the final song in Bedlam that Anne sings to him, Gently Little Boat, is the most perfect lullaby. And it's hard to sort of put it together with some of the other dissonant music you've heard, the Devil's Chord and so on, but it's unbelievable, his music. You just cannot believe that one person wrote it, and raises the bar for all composers I'm working with now. I work with a lot of living composers.
Speaking of which, what's coming up on the Robin Guarino calendar?
I'm actually directing a world premiere in Cincinnati next year called Blind Injustice, which is about the true life stories of six people who were falsely convicted of crimes and then freed through an innocence project after, about a cumulative 140 years in jail. And it's a kind of a jazz fusion classical opera. And so that's the next big thing that I'm doing. I'm also directing L'Incoronazione di Poppea at Florentine Opera, and a couple other things. But
well, great. Well, keep us informed for things that are happening around the Bay Area.
Oh, thanks.
Robin Guarino is directing the Marilla Opera Program's production of The Rake's Progress. It's tonight at 7:30 and Saturday at 2 at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music on Oak Street, MEROLA, Marilla.org for more information. We should mention that KLW is a media sponsor for the Marilla program. We should also mention that Marilla has served as quite a proving ground for hundreds of artists who have gone on to extensive careers in opera, including the aforementioned Hadley Adams, starring in the West Edge Opera production of Quartet. Other artists that have made the program a success story include Anna de Trebko, Patricia Rossette, Carol Van Ness, Debbie Hoyt, Joyce DiDonato, Thomas Hampson, Patrick Summers, many others. In this particular production, watch for these names down the road. As Tom Rakewell, you'll hear Christopher Oglesby, and True Love is sung by Megai Zhang. Nick Shadow is Jacob Zarfman, and Baba the Turk is Anne McGuire, among others in that cast. Let's go out now with the epilogue from The Rake's Progress. Again, you can see this tonight at the Conservatory of Music or Saturday afternoon. Robin, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
Here's the epilogue from The Rake's Progress. Part of the epilogue from The Rake's Progress by Igor Stravinsky being staged by the Marilla Opera Program tonight at 7:30, Saturday at 2, Marilla, MEROLA.org for more information on that. Still to come, Peter Robinson will talk with Jean Walker Harvey about her new book, Boats on the Bay. And I'm David LaTulipe, your host for Open Air, who was AWOL for a couple of weeks. And in my absence, my steadfast producer, Neil Swinkles, had a talk with Jeffrey Thomas about the American Bach Festival's American Bach Festival. Here's that conversation.
Jeffrey Thomas, we are broadcasting this interview on the eve of the 9th Annual American Bach Soloists Festival and Academy. It starts tomorrow and runs through August 12 at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music and at the beautiful St. Mark's Lutheran Church in San Francisco. You are the artistic director of the American Bach Soloists. For the few listeners who may not be familiar with your organization and what it does, can you give us a brief overview and tell us about the purpose of the festival and the Academy in general?
Well, sure. Let's see. We were founded, 30 years ago. We were just beginning our 30th season, and the idea way back then was to put together an ensemble comprised of those of us who found ourselves, you know, in one town or another, one month to the next, all being engaged to perform early music with different conductors, you know, and that comes with its rewards and sometimes with its disadvantages. So we wanted to have a go at it by ourselves, and we formed this ensemble. And in the beginning, lots and lots of Bach cantatas. They were underperformed, probably still are. Then we expanded the rep, and then eventually had a summer festival in Marin County in Belvedere for many years, and then moved it here to San Francisco when we inaugurated an academy, a training program for well, we'd call them young professionals. They're really people who are emerging from their professional studies programs, and just at that point, just at that cusp of being ready to break into professional careers. So they're phenomenally talented and ready to soak up everything that our faculty have to offer to them and to help them, you know, get on their way. And each festival has focused on a theme that's really mostly for the benefit of the audiences, so that every year it's a little different. We've had themes about Versailles, we've had themes of Venice, and this year we're focusing on one that comes to mind perhaps less often for most music listeners, but it's Dresden, the wonderful city of Dresden, which had the finest orchestra in Europe during the Baroque era, which means that it had the finest virtuoso players and composers who wrote fantastic music for them. So the music this weekend, tonight and tomorrow night, is really stunning.
We are taping this a week early, this interview. What does the week before the festival in the Academy look like for you?
Well, all the participants arrive early on Monday morning to begin their 2 weeks of rehearsals and master classes and coachings and lectures and all that. It's a very, very busy time. We immediately throw ourselves into rehearsals for Bach's Mass in B minor, which we present every summer with this Academy orchestra and the Academy singers as vocalists. And also, together they present an opera, usually an opera, sometimes an oratorio. So the first week is full of that. We get the full schedule going. For example, in the morning, participants will have an orchestral rehearsal probably in the afternoon. They work on Bach arias or they work on chamber music. Then they go to master classes, attend lectures. It's a very dense schedule, and by the end, people are exhausted but very, very happy by it. And then, of course, all along at the same time, American Bach Soloists are rehearsing our programs, which are on the two weekends. On the first weekend, the two programs featuring music from Dresden, which includes some Bach and Vivaldi, actually. And then on the second weekend, it's a wonderful program of music from the area around Dresden and from Germany in general.
The 2018 edition of the festival and the Academy is called the Glorious Court of Dresden. What is so special about the Court of Dresden?
Well, the two kings of Poland, Augustus II and Augustus III, had also been the electors of Saxony. So through this very unusual situation of the union of the Catholic state of Poland and the sort of Protestant state of Germany, led to the reign of these two men, these two kings, who absolutely loved the arts and everything about them, everything peripheral to them. I suppose being king can affect one's ego a little bit, and you would want to put on the very best show. But I also believe, and I think it's clear, that they genuinely really were interested in the finest music that they could make happen there at the court. They searched throughout Europe for the best musicians and poured funds into music and other forms of art as well. What happened then was the orchestra, the court orchestra, was the first to develop into a really virtuoso band, which, of course, it still is today. It's the same as the Dresden Orchestra today. But back then, of course, much smaller. One of the interesting aspects of why this orchestra got to be so good and why its reputation was so well known throughout Europe is because really for one of the first times ever, each orchestral player had to know how to play only one instrument. Before that, they were responsible for several. Suddenly, they dropped that requirement, which led to the increased virtuosity of these players that only had to be great at one thing, and they each became very great at what they did. And this really elevated the standard of performance very quickly. It was seen as that by other musicians throughout Europe who were envious. Bach wrote down how envious he was at Dresden because these players only had to play one instrument, whereas his musicians had to play, the flute and the violin, maybe kettle drums, all at the same time, and in a great hurry for each Sunday. So it was really the object of desire for so many performers and composers during the Baroque era, and all that together led to just this really stunning music that came from that court.
This is the festival and academy. What does the academy part entail, and who participates in it?
Well, the academy participants do come pretty fresh out of their probably graduate study programs in performance. They also, maybe some didn't come through academia, but are at that point in their career. This is not a summer camp kind of a thing. This is really 72 extremely talented people, so many of whom have become members of American Bach Soloists. It wasn't designed to do that, but this is what has happened, and I am so thrilled every time I have an ABS rehearsal now to see so many of these new members of our orchestra that have come to us, that appeared to us through this academy. They work very hard with all their teachers, and it's very sort of cross-disciplinary. In other words, the flute teacher or the oboe teacher might coach violin students, here and then during the week. So the participants get a very broad perspective of what they're doing. The lectures that we give to them also open up their minds, we think. It's interesting to remember. We have to always remember that younger people have had less experience, especially with the history of music performance. We all can think of recordings that we've known and loved for 30 years. They have maybe never heard them. So we have a lot to inform them about in terms of the history of what they're doing. But generally, they come with such enthusiasm and energy, and that it inspires all of us on the faculty terrifically.
About this year's program, there's several concerts on the on the schedule. One, as a Dutchman, I'm very interested in because it says it's the farewell performance of Dutch bass baritone Max van Egmond. How long have you known each other?
I have known Max since sometime in the 1980s, and it all came down to a story which may be too long for your listeners right now, but I was an Adler Fellow at the SF Opera, and a very interesting lady came backstage after I sang a performance of a Scarlatti opera, and she asked if I wanted to sing some Bach, and she had a little group here in the Bay Area that she had formed. Well, her name was Lorette Goldberg, and she had formed Philharmonia Baroque, which then was three people, basically, a trio. I think she was the harpsichordist. Anyway, she asked me if I'd sing a Bach concert. I showed up for the first rehearsal and was astonished to see two of the most famous Baroque musicians I had ever heard of and anyone will ever hear of, the great harpsichordist and conductor Gustav Leonhardt and Max van Egmond, who I had been listening to for probably 10 years on this incredible series of recordings. All the Bach cantatas came out on the Teldec label way back in the 70s, maybe. So I was just blown away by that opportunity. We've been colleagues and friends ever since, and when we founded this academy 9 years ago, I knew right from the beginning Max is, well, he's the most famous early music baritone ever, and he has an incredible intellect and mind, and is a superb teacher, and we have benefited by that. Our singing participants have benefited from that for the last 9 years. He retired from singing officially some years ago, but still sings a little bit, And now he's decided in his 80s that he wants to retire from these summer visits to San Francisco, which he has always loved. He loves this city very, very much and has always looked forward to it. And there will be a tear or two when he finishes singing a beautiful Bach aria on the Saturday night of the second weekend. That's on the 11th of August, a gorgeous cantata. And that will be the last time we'll hear him in this context. Hopefully, again, some other way. But we will miss him terribly, and so will our participants. But it has been an incredible joy and a luxury, I think, to have him here for these 9 years.
One of the highlights of the program is in a performance of Handel's Semele. Talk about that.
Well, Semele is one of those operas that has a lot of tunes that people recognize. There's a beautiful aria, Where Ere You Walk, and there's a famous another aria, Iris Hensaway, that mezzo-sopranos sing always, constantly. Their teachers give them that one. It's full of great music. It's a wonderful story about Semele and Jupiter. But Semele wants to experience Jupiter in his full godlike glory. She doesn't realize that that would actually end her life. That's the way these things go. But meanwhile, Jupiter's wife, Juno, is, of course, not happy that Jupiter is hanging out with Semele. So there's the plot, basic triangle, basic trio. Handel came to that piece in the 1740s. He had written Messiah in 1742. We know he had this fantastic career as an opera composer in the 10s and 20s and early 30s, 1700s in London. Tastes changed. People didn't like anymore his kind of Italian opera. You know, he had been at the top of the heap, and now there was competition from rival companies. The whole thing, I think, became rather unsavory for him, and he saw that he wanted to focus on something else. So it became the English oratorios. Semele, with that plot I just described, was actually the oratorio then that was presented during the Lenten season when opera didn't exist. But Lenten audiences were certainly not expecting to go see a storyline about an adulterous relationship and all that. So it didn't do well at all in the moment, unfortunately. Yet it's filled with gorgeous music, and eventually it became performed by opera companies all across the world because it's a perfect operatic plot. So it's kind of on the cusp, oratorio slash opera, which is it? It really doesn't matter. I think probably to call it oratorio is a little bit of a misnomer, considering that we generally think of oratorios as having sacred stories, sacred storylines. But this is clearly not that. And it's, you know, complete with earthquake scenes and wonderful choruses, just fantastic arias. So it is every year we choose a piece like this for the Academy vocalists and orchestra to perform. And so that's the one this year. It's a delight. I've been loving studying it. I think I sent out a tweet a few months ago, you know, love Semele, and I got all these responses back. So there are a lot of fans for this piece out there.
This is the 9th festival in the Academy. What part of it do you look forward to most?
Of this festival? You know, I think this year, well, you mentioned one of the things already, to hear Max von Eckmann sing. These programs about the music of Dresden are just fantastic programs. There's the first program is mostly music by composers who lived there, who wrote specifically for that orchestra, incredibly virtuosic trumpet concerto, flute concerto, violin concerto, and orchestra works. The second concert is music that was sent to Dresden. For example, there's a recently discovered Vivaldi Dixie Dominus found about 10 years ago, and the people have been raving about it ever since. It's, if you like Vivaldi, you will love this piece. And there's a Bach cantata that Bach wrote to celebrate the second year of the reign of the second Augustus. So this was in the around 1734. He was in the habit of writing celebratory cantatas for patrons to celebrate their birthdays or their name days, as it was done back then. In this case, Bach wanted to work at Dresden. He really, really wanted a job there. He had sent the first half of what would be the Mass in B minor forward, saying, if you like this, would you please give me a court title? Leipzig was not a comfortable job for him. Some of the musicians were not up to his standards, of course, and the salary wasn't good enough for his very large family. Dresden would have been a dream come true. So he often wrote fantastic music that would flatter the king or flatter the electors, and that's the cantata that's going to be performed.
Do you already know what next year's theme will be?
I don't. We're thinking about it. It will probably be perhaps Italian music, but we do rotate a bit. But we tend to sit around at the end of each festival and decide, as a faculty and as the ABS performers, what we would like to do. So we have a couple ideas, but nothing official yet.
Well, I look forward to finding out. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Niels. Thank you.
And my thanks to producers Niels Swinkels for talking with Jeffrey Thomas about the American Bach Festival. AmericanBach.org for more information. Here's just a touch of the incredible Bach Mass in B minor. To finish out today's edition of Open Air, I welcome regular contributor Peter Robinson with a special guest. Hi, Peter.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And indeed, my guest today, Gene Walker Harvey, has just got a beautifully illustrated book out called Boats on the Bay. And, of course, immediately makes me think about that poem by John Masefield, I Must Go Down to the Sea Again, to the Lonely Sea in the Sky, and All I Ask is a Tall Ship and a Star to Steer Her By. Gene, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you very much, Peter.
And I know this is a book which covers all sorts of different illustrated books, boats floating, but in fact you live in Sausalito and you look straight onto the bay, is that correct?
Yes, I do. I'm very fortunate to walk along the bay and admire all the beautiful boats, kayak by all the different houseboats in Sausalito, and admire the whole myriad of boats we're so lucky to have on the San Francisco Bay.
So this particular book is directed to young people to encourage them to enjoy the outdoors and to get out on the water. And the first, in fact, as you just mentioned, it is a picture of a houseboat, but then it goes on to tell you about the different types of boats. And I like the subtitle here. It's called A Fishing Boat Slogs Through the Fog. So tell me about that.
Exactly. So this is a large format picture book for the ages 4 to 8, although all audiences can enjoy our amazing boats on the bay. And so the fishing boat slogs through the fog. Often in the early hours of the morning, I will see the fishing boats with the birds trailing behind and heading through the fog. Mm-hmm. Out through the Golden Gate Bridge.
And the illustrator in this, Grady McFerrin, has done all the different drawings so that we get that whole collage effect. And, of course, next, something very close to my heart, a ferry carries passengers. I did do the On the Ferry column for years. And this looks a little bit like the Red and Gold Ferry or Blue and Gold. I can't tell which ferry it is, in fact.
Yes, it's... As you spoke about Grady McFerrin, he did beautiful illustrations for this picture book. They're watercolor and pen and ink. He is also a graphic designer in Los Angeles, so he brings such a unique, incredible style with touches of whimsy. Some pages include an enormous whale below a kayaker, the details that children would love to see. And
now, later this month, you're going to be at the Book Passage in Sausalito, and you're going to be signing. So tell us a little bit about that event.
Yeah, so first of all, our community is so thrilled to have the amazing Book Passage Now in Sausalito, they have Book Passage by the Bay and right on the water looking out at the boats. And I will be there for the book release on Saturday, August 25th at 2 p.m. And the public's obviously welcome, and we'll be doing a reading and have boat activities. And it'll be a very special day to launch
the
book.
And I'm right in saying that all the profits from this particular book go towards the Matthew Turner, which is a tall ship building operation. So tell us a little bit about that.
Exactly. So it's in Sausalito. There's a nonprofit educational organization called Call of the Sea, and they have a tall ship already built, and that they use to take children out on the ocean, called the Seaward. But over the past several years, they've been building an enormous tall ship called the Matthew Turner, modeled after the tall ships built in the late 1800s. Matthew Turner was a shipbuilder over in Benicia who built over 150 ships there. And the idea is to bring students out to the water, to let them experience the ocean, transform their world through sailing, become environmental stewards. So it's an incredible organization. I feel very lucky to be able to help them in any way to support it. It's been built by volunteers.
And they also take school kids out on the bay in different boats.
Yep. Absolutely. That's the focus, to experience the ocean. And they actually invited me to join them this summer with a group of third grade campers. And you could see the thrill for these students, most who had never been out on the ocean at all. And it was a true delight.
And I'm looking at one illustration here. A dredger scoops up mud and muck, but in front of it is the word coffee. And when I used to write the on the ferry column, to sip a morning of fog-lifting coffee was just the joy of being on the top deck. But I also think the book draws attention to the ecology and the environment. We've got a section on container ships, which reminds me about how the Port of San Francisco has changed and how Oakland has begun to take over the traffic. And then tell me about the fireboats. I see you finish with a fireboat here in the book.
A fireboat fans water high and wide. And just an example of one of the other the myriad types of boats we have on the bay. And that one is so appealing, obviously, to all of us, to see the water sparkling up in the up above the fireboats, because they can put on a show.
And, of course, we do finish with fireworks, which is another celebration. Now, before we go on to your next book, which came out earlier, it called My Hands Sing the Blues, I thought we'd hear a little bit of Art Tatum. This is really a outstanding piano piece where he kind of leads us in to a sense of the blues, a sense of how things are happening. And then we're going to talk a little bit about your book, My Hands Sing the Blues. Okay, so this is Art Tatum just getting us into the feel of the blues, and Gene Walker Harvey's book is actually called My Hands Sing the Blues. So tell me a little bit about this artist who was inspired by the blues.
Yes, so his name was Romare Bearden, and he painted during the Harlem Renaissance. I was inspired to write this book because I'm also a docent at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art for children, and the National Gallery brought an exhibit to the Museum of Modern Art of Romare Bearden, and children loved his huge collages that depict his childhood in North Carolina and then his life in Harlem. He said the jazz and blues inspired him because that's how he created his collages.
Yeah, so again, this is to inspire, I think, not only listening to the blues, but also to paint the blues.
Yes.
And he captures both. So, Gene, just tell us one more time when you're going to be in Sausalito talking about your first book, Boats on the Bay.
So I will be at Book Passage by the Bay in Sausalito on Saturday, August 25th at 2 p.m. And everyone is more than welcome. We'd
good,
love to see you.
Good to have you with us.
And Peter, well, we should mention that Jean's website is jeanharvey.com, G-J-E-A-N-N-E, harvey.com. You can learn more about Jean's works.
So I'm just going on to think that August is the month of holidays and travel. Why not turn your travel trip into a travel writing article? And this month, at three major outlets here in the Bay Area, Book Passage, starting on the 8th, is a travel writers conference, which will show you what to do. At Barnes & Noble in Corte Madera is a complimentary evening on August the 22nd, where we're talking about how to turn a trip into a story. And then on Angel Island on September the 1st, a travel writing workshop where you actually get to talk about the history, bring a camera, take the views, sense that whole experience of San Francisco in the past, start at the immigration station where Chinese immigrants were first placed, and put it together in a wonderful travel story. Now, if you want to find out more about each of these travel conferences, Book Passage, the number to call is 415-927-1503. That is Book Passage Travel Conference starting on the 8th. Barnes & Noble, August the 22nd, turn your trip into a travel story. The number there, 415-927-9016. And April the 1st on Angel Island, the San Francisco Literary Society, a travel story island, how to put it together. Area number 415-381-6671. So if you're planning for a vacation and you want to see your words in print, you have a camera, take a picture, write a caption, and you're off to a flying start to become that great thing in life, a travel writer.
Thank you, Peter, once again for offering such interesting things. A reminder that for those travel writing workshops, those numbers are posted at our website, klw.org. Look for the Open Air tab. Thanks, Peter. Thank you, Gene. That's it for Open Air this week. My name is David Latuli, but big thanks to Peter Robinson for taking some hosting duties while I was frolicking among the redwoods in Monterio. Also, thanks to Renee Kemp for taking on some hosting duties. And as always, to Neil Swinkles, not only for his remarkable interview skills, but for his ability for keeping the Open Air calendar on track over these many weeks. Next week, if you're able to join us, we're going to be talking about the Word for Word 25th season and a rare production of stories by Tobias Wolff and George Saunders, featuring Wolff's Deep Kiss and Saunders' Victory Lap. Also, Ash Malloy, a Bay Area actor getting his MFA acting from ACT, is doing a production of My Name is Rachel Corey. You'll hear about that, as well as the Vazy South Asian Comedy Fest. That's next week on Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW. A reminder that our shows are archived at KALW.org. Thanks so much for listening.